echte ervaring.
You are listening to That Digital Show, a business podcast presented by Google Cloud to help organizations innovate and grow value in a digital world. Episode 37, Lessons from Google's In-House Incubator. In this episode, we'll kick off our digital masterclass series with Area 120 to give leaders an inside look at Google's approach to design, innovation, and strategy. Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Hood, a digital strategist at Google Cloud. Thank you for listening. If you haven't heard, Google Cloud Next 21 will be taking place from October 12th through the 14th, 2021. That's just in a couple of weeks here. We hope you're going to be joining us. You're going to hear from the world's leading companies and how they're solving some of their biggest challenges in the cloud and hear firsthand about their digital transformation journeys. And I'm excited because my co-host today will be having some fantastic discussions during Next. So mark your calendars, October 12th through the 14th, 2021, and sign up at g.co/cloudnext. Okay, I'm beyond excited about the next few episodes. Starting today, we are going to be presenting a digital masterclass series designed for leaders to help guide your technology, organizations, and people through cloud digital transformations. And I'm honored to be joined on this journey with Natalie Pucco, Cloud Technology Strategist at Google Cloud. Hello, Natalie. Would you mind sharing a little bit about yourself and what you do at Google?
Hi, Chris. Well, thank you so much. Wowee, what an introduction. I'm really looking forward to having these conversations with you. As you can probably hear, I have a very thick Australian accent, if that gives you an indication to where I'm from. I'm Australian. I've just spent the last 2 years in Europe working out of London. And yeah, you're exactly right. I'm a cloud technology strategist and I work alongside some of our largest, most strategic partnerships at Google. And I guess my superpower is very much this cross-section between being a cloud engineer and cloud technologist, but then also working alongside our business teams and our leaders inside organizations that are really driving forward large-scale transformations, and also looking at how they can use the most innovative technology as part of their business in data, AI, analytics. I guess I have a very interesting job and I get to work alongside of a lot of curious leaders who have often said to me, how do we do things inside Google? Tell us more about that magic. And that's what led me to you, Chris.
So we've been chatting about this actually for a little while now. And this Digital Master Series is your idea. This is your vision. So I would love to hear from you. What do you have in store for us?
As I mentioned, I speak with leaders across large organizations almost every day, CTOs, CIOs, CEOs in banking, retail, media, and they all have a very, very similar question, Chris. The question is, how do we innovate inside Google? And the purpose of these discussions were, how can I take all those discussions that I have with these leaders across the world and how can we put them in a bottle and how can we share them for all the other leaders inside those large organizations that want to hear that magic? And the idea of this masterclass series is that we're going to open source Google innovations and talk about how we build and give really practical, actionable leadership advice that you can take away and implement today in the business that you lead. We're going to be speaking to Google experts, industry leaders, and customers to actually share their experiences and best practices in the things that went well, the things that didn't go well in leading these digital transformations. So that's really where the inspiration came from. How can we bottle up these conversations and share them with other leaders who are driving similar technology change in their business?
I love it. And to kick the series off, we are going to take a peek into Google's internal ideas incubation hub, Area 120, and help our listeners really understand what it takes to start their own grassroots ideas and innovation team. Natalie, who is joining us today?
Well, we are very, very lucky to have Paul Lambert joining us today. Paul, tell us a little bit about yourself and share your background.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. And it's kind of you to say that. We'll get into the job soon. I'm an entrepreneur by background.
My first real job was running an education technology company that I founded while I was in grad school in Canada. And that actually eventually pivoted to be more enterprise focused. So we helped generally technology companies build customer facing training, certification, universities that would help their own customers become more effective. Was the CEO of that for 6 years. Then I thought I should learn how it's done properly rather than just teach myself as an entrepreneur. So the company was sold to a larger competitor of ours who was based in California, got me to Silicon Valley, and I've been a product manager around here for about the last 6 years, first at Twitter and now at Google for about five.
So one of the things that we do on the show is ask our guests, what is the last thing you've downloaded? So is there anything that you'd like to share, something you've watched, listened to, read?
Do attachments count? Because I feel like I stream most content these days. I downloaded a pitch deck today. So right now at Area 120, there's our application deadline actually is today. So we're getting a lot of pitch decks submitted. So sometimes I download those and read them. Sometimes I even print them out. I'm pretty old school.
Yeah, it sounds like a perfect segue into tell us about Area 120. I mean, when you hear the name Area 120, it sounds quite exciting and kind of like, what is it? What even does Area 120 mean? Like, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it isn't a secret UFO lab. I will say that. So the Area 51 analogy is sometimes where people go, the 120 comes from 20% time, 100% of the time. And the whole idea of 20% time is employee-led innovation. It's been part of Google culture from the very, very early days. It's part of the IPO letter from 2004. And so we wanted to really hang our hat on that and be a bastion maybe of that feeling, that belief. So that's where Area 120 comes from. You'd see a lot of entrepreneurial small teams of Googlers working really, really hard to bring new products to life and new businesses to life. So we are an incubator. We help ideas go from pitch decks, the very first stage sort of concepts, through to real products in market that are generally not scaled, but there's proof of existence, both that the product can be built and delivered and that there are some customers or users out there who find value in it. So our process is we invite any Googler to submit this format, this pitch deck, and we get a bunch of those coming in twice a year. It just happens that today is exactly one of those deadlines for the fall cohort. We get around 100 per cycle. We have a whole team of people help review those, and we will go back and forth with the teams, and we invite a section of those to come in. About 10 to 20% of those will come in and pitch in person, and then about half of those are invited to come into the program for 6 months where we fund their headcount within the company and we give them budget to operate with, and they get to try to take that vision that they had and make it real. And after 6 months, there's a check-in where we do another evaluation, and about half the teams continue and half the teams are discontinued. And the ones that are continued get incremental funding and those projects grow. After about 1 to 3 years, normally, those projects will then be acquired or graduate back into a part of Google and become part of the Google portfolio of products.
So I wanted to take a short step back. You mentioned it a little bit, 20%. And believe it or not, this podcast was a 20% project for me. And it's turned into much more. It's turned into that 100%, as you mentioned. But for a leader who's out there right now, managing their organization, and they're thinking about innovation, when you say 20% for your staff, what does that really mean? What does that look like to a leader who may want to try to implement this at their organization?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It obviously depends a lot on the organization in terms of the market they're operating in, the type of employees they have. But broadly speaking, if you believe that you have a lot of really smart, creative people with good ideas, and that you as a leader only have insight into probably a fraction of those. And so part of the strategy of 20% is a way to let more of those get some air, get some oxygen, and see if they can grow and become something bigger. But you let them grow to a point where it's easier to evaluate if there's something there. Of course, the cost is you're giving up some of that time that's working on core projects. And it does require a high degree of faith, I think, in essentially your workforce. And the truth of the matter is, I think this isn't a secret, that over time, the 20% time itself at Google has changed, right? Obviously, we still have it. As you said, the podcast stated here. But it's not as if every employee at Google is constantly working a 20% project. It is still largely self-driven, where people, they're aware of it and it exists there as a program, but people have to take that entrepreneurial drive. And we see 20% time, you know, being an entrepreneur, as you might think of it out in the startup ecosystem, is just sort of a gradient of people having been self-directed and wanting to have a vision and bring it to life.
Yeah, absolutely. I myself do love a 20% project. I've had the opportunity to work with the Google Photos engineering team, Rob Pike, the founder of Go Language, on his most recent project as a PM. And I think part of why people love coming and working with Google is that they, like similar to you, they do have these entrepreneurial backgrounds. And like a lot of organizations, if you have smart, passionate people, which you likely do, then how do we actually create a program or some governance around actually elevating those ideas? And like you said, for leaders inside Google, when we have our performance reviews twice a year, at least inside Google Cloud, we have this section that we're measured on, and it's all around 10x. In our teams, we're actually measured by what is the 10x project that you've worked on in the last 6 months. And that actually becomes part of the KPIs. So it's not just, hey, yeah, sure, go and do this 20% time, but then none of the leaders are really bought into it. At least in Google Cloud, it's actually part of what you're being measured on, whether it's a full 20% or not. But it is this idea that we're encouraging Googlers to think outside the square in their everyday role.
Yeah, I think that's super important. I'm glad you touched on it. What the company rewards is sort of, that shows what it actually values, sometimes more than, say, value statements, right? And so I think the way everyone is incentivized and promotions are given out and compensation is allocated and valuable projects are allocated and really just like what is recognized as success, who's being put on stage. Yeah, it says a lot. So I think actually different parts of Google have implemented that in different ways. So actually, I'm very happy to hear that Cloud is specifically a 10x part of their performance reviews.
So it was interesting that you mentioned you were an entrepreneur. And I think a lot of people who are in Area 120 are entrepreneurial spirited, at least. One of the things that I learned as an entrepreneur was everybody has an idea. And I think part of the innovation process is, sure, we can pitch ideas, we can send them. We have to come up with some level of validity, whether that idea is going to work or not. But ideas are a dime a dozen, so to speak. How do you go through a process of bringing in all these ideas, these pitch decks that you're getting, and filter through them to determine what's going to be focused on? Is there a scale? Is there some sort of measurement that you're looking for? Is there just, wow, this is a brilliant idea and we can't pass it up? What does that process look like?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right in that there's a lot of people can generate a lot of ideas, but not all ideas are created the same. It very much is a hits-based business in the same way film or content might be. It's not that hard to think up movie script, but it's pretty hard to think up a really good one. And business ideas are similar. What I think those of us who have been around this for a while have tried to do is build up frameworks and some rigor around predicting and fostering promising ideas into even better ones. So the way we do it at Area 120 is we have four broad buckets that we evaluate our pitches on. So those are team. So we're looking at individuals on the team and how strong they are, but also the chemistry between the team members. So have these people worked together before and how well they are fit for the specific problem they're trying to solve. Do they have domain experience in the domain, or is it the right skill sets that we think will be required to solve the specific problem that they're addressing? Team is one bucket. Second one is value creation, which if I had to pick one as the most important, I might pick that, which is just that we have a very strong belief that there is some large unsolved problem that if we're able to solve it, we're creating new value in the world. And that value is going to be distributed for customers and users and for the company, and it's going to be split some way, but that's almost not that important as long as you grow the pie and genuinely believe there's a lot of value creation there. And that encompasses both understanding the problem and understanding the solution. Because like it's very clear that, say, a cure for cancer would create a ton of value, but it's really hard to do. So we need to both identify a really large problem and then also believe that we have some ability to solve it, generally uniquely, because if we didn't uniquely solve it, it'd probably already be solved or some competitors would be solving it. So there's value creation. And the third bucket is Google fit. Unlike, say, an external investment fund, we are incubating projects to join the Google product portfolio. And there are many, many things that Google doesn't do, right? We're a big company, but there are many, many more markets that we don't play in than the ones that we do. We can build a great business at Area 120 and still not have a home for it. We have to have a pretty good thesis that there is a product strategy that is going to be there in 2 to 3 years. So we're trying to predict the future that this will be an accelerant to. That's also a pretty hard part of the job and involves a lot of navigating the strategies of all the different executives at Google. And then the fourth part is Area 120 fit, which is there are certain things we're just good at and we're not. Like each one of the partners have their own background, their own strengths. We have a certain amount of capital we can allocate. So if we don't do capital intensive projects, we're not doing hardware, we're not doing infrastructure type work. We have our own sweet spot and we want to make sure we're playing in it. So we grade them all across those four things.
And let's just say I've come to you, Paul, with an amazing idea that you've chosen to come and join the Area 120 incubator. Can you help us understand the funding model associated with that? And I ask this because I've seen more businesses, particularly with the shift to cloud and on-demand resources, kind of moving from this CapEx to OpEx model, where instead of saying, here, team, here's a sum of money, kind of go forth and create, they're using more of this startup VC funding model. If I'm a leader of a business, I say, come to me with an idea. Here's some money or some budget to go and get it started. This is like your seed funding. And then when that idea grows, then here's your Series A, Series B. And then eventually we kind of get to this IPO stage where it gets implemented or integrated back into the business. How do you think about funding? Because I know a lot of different leaders are listening, are probably really interested to hear about how you actually allocate budget for these ideas.
Yes, I'll start on what I think is sort of the commonality, because I think it'd be easy to get mired into maybe the Google specific approaches. But the basics is runway. So as a startup entrepreneur as well, you're generally calculating your runway. Right? For a given burn rate, how many employees you have, how much your expenditure, and how much money you have in the bank, that's how many months you have to see if you can get your plane off the ground. And we essentially allocate runway as well. So the main currency within Google and our main cost centers are really our employees. So is headcount. Headcount is sort of our internal currency. And then we also have OpEx budget that we use so that these projects can buy marketing or whatever it is that they need to do. We fund in periods of runway for headcount and OpEx. The OpEx is a number, so we give X dollars to the team. But to start off, we'll give 6 months of a certain number of headcount. So it's about 3 to 5. A typical team composition would be someone in a product manager, team lead type role, 2 to 3 engineers, potentially a UX designer. But of course, this all is variable depending on the market they're in. So yeah, initially it's 6 months. And then after 6 months, if things are looking good and we think we have some initial sign of product market fit, we'll move to 1 year cycles. And like I said, initially 3 to 5 headcount, we'll grow that all up to about 10 to 15 over the course of 2 years. When we get past 15, we have found that what ends up happening is we end up creating redundancy with other parts of Google. So it doesn't really make sense for our projects to, for example, build a sales force from scratch. We already have amazing sales teams in both the ad side of the organization and the cloud side of the organization. So we get to a certain point where it just is a lot more efficient. It makes more sense for us to join one of the existing PAs. And at that point, if we're talking about scaling, we've probably already proven out what we were supposed to prove at Narrowing 20. And it's really a strong sign that, okay, this thing is ready to be graduated and be prime time.
Speaking of graduation, can you help us understand adoption and finding a happy home for these ideas once they do graduate from Area 120? At some point, they need to live somewhere. And how do you bring prospective teams or product units on the journey with these ideas as they do get launched? Because at some point, these ideas likely need to sit in an existing P&L of some kind. They have to work with someone else's KPIs, and the success and failure oftentimes too needs to be carried by somebody. How do you manage that process of integrating back to the business?
That is probably the single largest part of my job. Part of it is doing the funding, but the teams do the real work of building the product. Yeah, there's a lot here. So on one hand, you want to be super aligned with the leaders around the company to understand what their goals are, their strategies, their objectives, what the bets that they're making, so you can help support those. Because ultimately, like you said, you're going to need some executive, somebody who owns a P&L somewhere to say, yes, we are going to essentially acquire this product. And in some ways, it's not that different from the type of thesis that would drive an M&A acquisition. They're buying a product or business because they believe it is going to accelerate their strategy. But at the same time, because we're internal to Google, we don't want to be too close to their strategy because, I mean, they have their own funding and they would probably just fund it themselves if it was too close. And there is risk of confusion in the market and internal confusion of sort of competing with ourselves too closely. So we kind of have to walk this line where we're not way out in left field so that we're relevant. We're not too close to home either so that we're stepping on toes or causing any kind of conflicts. And so we really got to sort of be in that maybe 2 to 3 year time horizon where it's far enough out that probably not the next quarter or next year's OKRs, but it's not way out either. That's one of the things that really differentiates, say, Area 20 from, say, Google X. I know them as a moonshot factory. They're making big, large, long-term bets, really swinging for the fences is what they're known for. We are really just trying to be that next time horizon on behalf of the rest of the PAs. So we're either going to take a high-risk bet that has a pretty good reward, but there's a lot of risk there, and we may not want to take that risk when we, say, have a core asset that we don't want to put at risk. And maybe I can be more specific. Say you have something like Gmail. It is risky, as we found out when we built Inbox, to try to displace that with an unproven alternative email system. And doing that within a core PA is even more risky because you risk taking the attention away from all the people who are working on this amazing product you've already built. So somewhere like Area 20 is a safer place to do that because you can kind of sequester it off, see if it does well. And then if it turns out that low probability but high payoff bet does pay off, then you can bring it in. If it doesn't, which is a likely case, it didn't have all those incremental costs of distraction and confusion.
One of the things we talk about a lot is the ability to fail fast. So I want to take the opposite look at this and address all of the ideas that get rejected. What happens? Do you have a repository of those ideas? Have you ever gone back and said, oh, there was an idea from a couple of years ago that I think we could brush the dust off and reuse this? How many times have people generated ideas, get rejected, and generate another idea? What's the frequency of this? I mean, anything about the rejects, I have to know.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of questions in there. For one, rejected is a harsh word that comes out on many different levels, but there's different phases. For one, there's sort of initial pitch deck. We decide not to come in. People come in person and pitch. A lot of the early formation part of the job is matchmaking. Actually, I'm going to tell a concrete story. So one of the products that we just graduated to Google Cloud is now going to be part of the cloud portfolio is a product called Tables, which is sort of a hybrid between a database and a spreadsheet. And the product manager for that actually had pitched a totally separate idea, but had some background in productivity and had previously worked on the Sheets team. And there was another team that had pitched essentially an early version of what Tables was, very strong engineering team, but didn't have a PM. And so we did some matchmaking there and said, hey, we don't really love that idea that PM pitch, but we think you're an awesome PM and you seem to have a great back. Why don't you talk to this other team and see if there's any chemistry? And there was some chemistry. They got along famously, joined together, and they built Tables, and now it's been a huge success. So that often happens. We, of course, have every pitch deck that's ever been submitted, and we haven't yet done any like large-scale data mining on them, but maybe that'll be somebody's 20% time, some machine learning engineer somewhere, but we haven't done that yet.
So let's look a little bit about the overall process, the time that you've spent at Area 120. What are some of the things that really have stuck out in your mind that you might want to share with some of the leaders who are listening?
So first off, the basic thesis that there are a lot of smart people out there, a lot of good ideas, is true. The scarce commodity for us is more the people side, but there's a lot of insight, real genuine insight that's coming in these pitch decks that we are all, if we are sitting in a round of a room as a bunch of leaders of this program, could never come up with ourselves. One of the other things we have found, the flip side of that, is that because of the context of being inside a large company and building a product that isn't just an external startup, but needs to navigate within the corporate context, having leaders of even these projects that either have managerial experience or have some experience navigating that is actually quite important. The sort of classic stereotype of a really successful external entrepreneur might be like Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates, who founded their companies at like at 19, had never really worked at companies, were, you know, essentially geniuses that made these major successes. We have a lot of trouble making those bets because there's just such a learning curve to sort of operating within the corporate context. So we have found that we can pair these really ambitious, incredibly bright people who might be earlier in their careers with maybe more seasoned managers, maybe a pairing that you wouldn't require as much on a startup where you can sort of take higher risks and you can make more bets. But for us, in our context, that was important. It was an important learning, and we've shifted the way that we build teams now as a result of that.
You raise a really important point there around operating in the corporate context. And again, a lot of the leadership listening is probably thinking, hey, this Area 120 idea sounds great, but how does this actually work in reality in my business? And at least the experience that I've had working and advising leaders in large organizations is I've oftentimes seen two very, very common scenarios. Some organizations believe that their big ideas come from the actual business, those who work closest to the customer or patient or shop floor, whatever it might be. But oftentimes, if we leave these big ideas to come just from the business, oftentimes they kind of flop or die because it's business as usual and they have day jobs and like they talk about these same ideas for 5 years and it goes on and on and on, and then it either never happens or the opportunity is passed. Or I've worked with other leaders in other organizations and they do the flip, where they have a dedicated incubation hub where it's kind of removed from the business, but their jobs is dedicated to generating these own ideas. And sometimes it actually happens in this kind of little bubble, and then, you know, out pops an idea and the business was never consulted. They didn't understand the value. They didn't even know the team. And then that idea gets no buy-in or no investment from the business. So they're kind of two common scenarios that I've seen. And it almost feels like we need this kind of happy medium in between. Now, of course, Area 120 is one way of doing that. I'm sure there's others. But how does that statement resonate with you in terms of what we're seeing a lot of our leaders who we work with in the cloud? How can they take the lessons of Area 120 away?
Yeah, that's a great framing and a great question. And I think you've had more experience maybe speaking to some of those other organizations, but seems totally believable to me. And we've been on our own journey in that way, where early days Area 20 was much more of that almost sequestered incubator, like early days Area 20, you needed a special badge to get in kind of thing. And they had their own building. And we've learned over time that we actually ran into exactly the issues you said, where you can't just show up, or you can, but it's fraught to show up and say, hey, look at this amazing thing we did. You haven't heard about us before. Will you now come in and adopt our product and invest in it? And that we're a lot more successful if we are hand in hand bringing leaders along the way. So for example, we try to get senior stakeholders, whatever the right role is for a project, from the part of Google they would likely join if they were to graduate and say 2 to 3 years down the road as advisors as early as possible. Sometimes we even have dotted line reporting structures into that part to sort of formalize the input from the business into the projects. So that addresses one issue you pointed out. And I think the other one is like exactly the sort of top of funnel for your ideas. I definitely know that if we just had partners or the core FIRs inside Area 20, like dreaming things up on the whiteboard, we would not have 10% of the diversity of ideas. And because it's a HIPS-based business, it's kind of a numbers business. You need a lot of different things to react to. And the ability that for, you know, like I said, any Googler to be able to submit pitch deck and then have that be malleable, right? It's not a binary accept reject, usually first pass, but a lot of them we look at and say, if there's something here, can we polish the stone into a diamond? Or, but, you know, we do some of the matchmaking, like the story I told you with tables, or we have some sessions and trying to dig into the idea and push on it and try to make it a little better. But if we didn't have that raw input coming from the whole company, we would just be working with a lot less raw material, which would hurt the whole system.
So we've covered a lot of different areas here. We've covered the 20%, we've covered funding, we've covered process and matchmaking. If we were to simplify this into, say, 3 core strategies that would help an organization implement some sort of Area 120 in their organization, what would be the 3 key steps that they need to think about?
The first would be getting a huge breadth of ideas. Even before that is the belief, that genuine belief, show it in your actions, that your employees are smart, creative people, and you give them that ability to share that. So that's number one, is just source a lot of ideas. Number two, I think, is creating some sort of separate structure so that these things can grow. Because early ideas and early projects are delicate, and they often don't look great until they've grown up a little bit. And so you have to understand that it doesn't happen overnight. If you plant a small plant next to a giant tree, it may not grow because it won't get any sunlight. You need to give it some separation, but not so much separation that it's off in left field. So like we said, some advisors, some input, but some arm's length arrangement. And then number three, I would say that the other risk that we actually haven't really touched on yet is having real metrics and discipline around continuation and discontinuation of projects that you really hold yourself to. And I think there are also some incubators that, if I had to guess, are a little bit too, maybe like your traditional R&D lab that kind of tinker on things for a really long time and maybe aren't held to particular business metrics or projects. We just want to see what they turn out and they stick around for a long time. I like to think we have a lot of discipline in Area 20, and that's one of our superpowers. And it's also, honestly, one of the hardest parts of the job. Like we do shut down a lot of projects, and these are projects that people are deeply invested into. So it's not easy to do, but it's a huge part of what makes us successful, is that after every 6 months, we expect to see evidence of product market fit. And if we don't, we discontinue the project and we help those people find new jobs. If I had to recap, believe in ideas, get a bunch of them, create arm's length distance within the company, and then have discipline as you're evaluating them.
Source ideas, give them space to grow, and measure success.
Yes.
And not be afraid to make tough decisions.
Yes, it's not just measuring. It's also listening to what those numbers say and doing the actions.
Fail and fail fast.
So, Natalie, I think you have some rapid-fire questions.
Yes, I do. Paul, are you ready? One sentence answers. Here we go. What's the most interesting application of technology you've seen in the past, say, 6 to 12 months?
So I have seen a lot of internal things that I'm not sure if I should share yet, but I can tell you something that I know that we can build using the cloud AI platform that would really help me. We got a new house during the pandemic, and we're next to a big park. And it turns out my fence is pretty low and the deer like to come into my backyard. I'm also an avid gardener. So I'm basically at war with the deer in my backyard. And so we have these outdoor nest cams. And what I would like to do is run our video feed through an AI algorithm that's trained to detect deer that can then turn on our water sprinklers as soon as they see the deer jump over the fence. And I know it's possible to do, and we have all the AutoML tools to do it. I just need to do it. We just need to like label a bunch of deer in pictures and get it deployed. But I think that would be a pretty fun application. If someone out there wants to build it, I will pay a subscription service. I will pay a monthly fee for that.
I was going to say, I guarantee that there's a listener out there that's emailing you right now saying, I can do this for you.
All we need is a model. All we need is a model.
Awesome. Next, what leadership advice have you been given that was so amazing you need to share with us, or so bad that you need to warn us?
I had a manager early in my career who was really into thinking of, I guess, maybe he watched too much Game of Thrones, but he really liked to think about sort of the power and politics within a company. And so he was always trying to advise me like to try to how to figure it out. And like, you have to be friends with this person or whatever. And in retrospect, it just seems like a bad character of like high school. And it didn't work out well for him. He actually didn't last that long in the company. And it made me realize that it was exactly the opposite of what you should do, which is just try to be honest with people and talk to people as almost everyone. I mean, I think everybody's coming from a good place and wants to do the right thing. So yeah, I guess it was just like, it stuck with me in such like a strong innate reaction. It's like, this is not how I want to work. That was probably the worst advice I ever got.
What's a lesson that keeps being put in front of you as a leader every day, over and over again?
There's two, and they kind of, I know you asked for one, but there's two that kind of go together. One is consistent messaging and being a cheerleader. People look to a leader to bring energy, bring inspiration, bring optimism. And you can do that in a genuine way in almost any circumstance. And also, it's so easy for messages to get mixed, or you don't even realize you're mixing them. You say I'm slightly different in an email, and you say something to someone else in a hallway, or I guess I'm back in hallways, virtual hallways. It is really clear to know sort of what your message is. Obviously, believe in that message, put a lot of thought into what it is, but once it's there, stick to it and bring the energy. People are going to want to work with you when they get inspired and energized by what you have to offer.
We often talk about active and visible leadership is a really key part of driving any large transformation at scale. And I completely agree that repetition of message and having that strong North Star is really key there. Absolutely. Final, fill in the blank for us, Paul. The most critical function of a high-performing team is?
Clear roles and honesty. I know that's two, but psychological safety, that's three. Knowing where everyone else is and having trust between those people.
Perfect answer.
Yes, thank you so much. That was awesome. I had a blast. Thank you, Paul. This has been an incredibly insightful conversation.
Thank you for having me. This is a real privilege, and it's an honor to be able to speak to your listeners and to share some of what we're doing at Aero120. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Natalie. I cannot wait to hear what you have in store for us next week.
It's a secret. I've got it planned. Looking forward to having our next conversation, and really enjoyed our conversation, Paul. Not only was it interesting, but it was really clear, tactical, tangible takeaways for leaders that are listening today. So thank you so much. Really enjoyed the conversation.
And thanks to all of you who are listening. As we mentioned at the start of today's episode, the Digital Masterclass series returns next week with another exciting conversation around innovation. You don't want to miss it. So visit the website, find us on your favorite podcast platform, and hit subscribe. Otherwise, if you have questions, comments, or ideas for the show, connect with us throughout social media and join us next week on That Digital Show. Thanks for listening.